Welcome to the Pro Cheerleading Podcast. This is the only podcast that gives you a raw and unfiltered perspective of what it's really like to be a professional cheerleader. Whether you're currently on a pro team, an alumni, or really curious about what it takes to become a pro cheerleader, the Pro Cheerleading Podcast gives you all the inside scoop and hot topics in the pro cheerleading industry and in-depth interviews of current and former cheerleaders. I'm your host, Makiba. Join me every Wednesday as I reveal the truth behind the palms. Welcome ye to the Pro Cheerleading Podcast. This episode is all about you and your wonderful film, A Woman's Work, the NFL's Cheerleader Problem. I just can't tell you how much I am just so excited to talk to you this episode. We have been waiting for you to come to Seattle for so long now, and this coronavirus better not mess up the film festival not next week, it's in a couple of weeks, so maybe.
Actually, I do have an update about that.
Oh no, don't tell me they canceled it.
So because, there was an order to cancel events of a certain size, so the theater and I both decided that I think it would be wise to reschedule the screening. And anyone who has bought tickets, like, they'll still honor it further down the road. But right now, with the situation of coronavirus, just, you know, people don't know what's going to happen. It's developing so fast, I think, in terms of public safety and stuff. They just decided it's better to reschedule.
Okay. I just looked at the site earlier this afternoon and they didn't have any announcements. So I was having, especially for smaller venues, I would think that it might be okay. But I guess the whole point is not to gather and to stay spread apart. And that's so disappointing.
It's unfortunate. I know, it's really unfortunate. But it's going to still happen. It's just like,
we just need things to calm down. We just need things to calm down.
Yes.
And okay, well then that means I'll have to be a little bit more patient. But you have to let me know if I need to be quiet and not give away any spoilers. But I just am so excited to talk about the film, the process in making it, everything that you've observed, learned, all of that. So let's get started. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
I'm excited.
Well, you mentioned possibly being down for some cheer chat. So I just want to, like, while we're on the corner, can I stop saying coronavirus? Like, I don't know why that is the way it wants to come out every single time. But I was actually supposed to travel to Portland on Sunday to go watch the Houston Rockets game and enjoy the Blazer dancers perform with Rip City Crew. Like, I was just so excited. I was going to be lazy and fly down there instead of drive. This was, you know, back before all this stuff took off. But just saw the announcement yesterday from the NBA about, you know, postponing the whole season.
Yeah.
It's just really getting real. And I just can't imagine, you know, for the dancers that have like 40 some odd games during the season, it's like their season's pretty much, I think it's kind of getting closer to the end of NBA, but still, like, right when all the momentum's building.
Yeah, it's heading toward the playoffs. I mean.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's
so crazy. So I'm super bummed about that. Now the film festival. I don't know what else could be canceled here, but how's it been where you are?
Well, LA, I don't know. I work from home, so I generally kind of don't go out that much. But I've been trying to, in a way, you know, whatever they call it, social distancing now. You know, I was supposed to go up to Big Bear, actually, this weekend with some friends, but we decided not to go. And so it's a little weird. I don't know. Definitely a lot of uncertainty. Like, you don't really know what's going to happen. Plus, my family, I was born in China and lived there till I was six. So a lot of my family is in China in a city called Chongqing, which is like maybe an hour away from Wuhan, where the epicenter of this happened. And, you know, since December, it's been like, there's a social media app called WeChat, which Chinese people use to like message each other all the time.
I got kicked off of WeChat for some reason.
What? Did you say something like politically sensitive?
No, I don't even know what happened. It's not to cut you off, but when I was at Starbucks, I became buddies with some of partners from our Shanghai office. And so they put me on WeChat and we're going back and forth sharing pictures from their visit to Seattle. And then all of a sudden I couldn't access the app. I couldn't download it again. Like, nothing. It was,
That's so weird.
I like that app though. It was fun.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like a combination of like Facebook and, you know, what's a messaging that? App.
Yeah.
But it's just been constantly like updates on what's happening. Like my uncle, like my family, they don't go out. They alternate, like according to your house number, they alternate days where you can leave the house. So you're actually not allowed to go out. And my grandparents are in a senior living home. And no one is allowed to go in and out. My grandpa's 95, so he's just been really confused. Like, he's pretty much deaf, so he can't really hear, and so communicating with him has been horrible, and he's had some health issues, and he had to go to the hospital. So it was just, like, really scary for a long time, and now it's kind of finally hitting the US, and I'm not sure what the government is doing right now. Like, I'm kind of very confused about that, so that doesn't really help calm your fears.
No, not at all. I can't even listen to the press conferences because I'm like, I
like every moment is like, are you serious?
Yeah. Well, the latest rumor is that the National Guard is on its way to Seattle, like, as we speak, and
no way.
Yeah, who knows? That's what I'm figuring out. Like, are you going to make sure we don't leave our house? Like, I think it's just extremely confusing and kind of scary. Now my kids are going to be home until April 24th.
Wow. Are they in college or high school or
what? High school and middle school. And so, but, you know, private and public schools in the three counties here in Washington State are now just shut down. And that's an extremely long time. And they're trying to get some, like, emergency food to continue to try to feed the kids that were, you know, on free or reduced lunch that I think relied on being in school to eat. So it's just kind of like utter chaos.
Yeah. And I wonder if this is going to impact, you know, the NFL season, because, you know, that's coming down the road in terms of preseason. But however, the other thing that is potentially going to impact the season is the collective bargaining agreement going around right now.
Yeah, there's so much going on.
Yeah.
So because of the NBA's announcement to postpone or, like, to take this hiatus, the NFL did make a statement that they don't plan on changing their season start date. So all of their preseason activities that happen, like from conditioning and all of that, it's supposed to still happen. I mean, I don't know in terms of the CBA, like, where things are. It's a lot. There's so much going on. I mean, it's kind of juicy, and just understanding how it trickles down. And you know, with audition season right now in the NFL as well, like, that's getting at least 100 plus 200 women together, women and men, you know, working out, sweating the whole nine yards. I'm curious if I know that the Seahawks postponed or canceled their audition prep workshop. I'm just curious to see if any of the dates will slide for auditions for some of the teams because of this too. So it's hitting home in a lot of crazy ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. I'm seeing even for dancers that, you know, follow on Instagram, you know, that, you know, make money from teaching classes and pay classes to train, and everything is just messing with everybody's schedule, money, opportunities, dancing, like everything's off. Everything's off.
I saw on Twitter that you posted, maybe it was like yesterday or something about the Mavs dancer.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Can we even talk about that?
Wait, why not?
While we're cheer chatting, so you might have heard one of the episodes listening of how fond I am of the Mavs president or CEO, Cynthia Marshall. So they went a little dark. I was obsessively watching towards the end of the summer to figure out what they were up to, since they definitely started the NBA season without any dancers. And I missed the announcement of them partnering with World of Dance for performances.
I saw that recently.
Yeah, but apparently, I just love our listeners because they'll slide into the DMs anonymously and kind of give me the skinny on what's what. And someone shared that article, and I was just like seething because I love the person who wrote it, because he at least kind of seemed to have the sarcasm a little bit of just like, how are you just going to sneak and put out a team to perform, like, out of nowhere? It's like midway through the season or past that, and all of a sudden you have, like, tumblers and stunters and dancers and, like, this whole little circus that they even were bragging about forming a long time ago. But she is a piece of work, that Cynthia. I cannot with her. But I had to post the article because it's just like, look at here. This is what we have.
Yeah, and I think it was saying, like, it includes, like, five or a handful of former Mavs dancers or something who have been practicing, and, like, I don't know. It's mind-boggling in terms of, like, when they announced, like, oh, we're going to change things up, and then it just sounded like they were throwing, like, everything out there. Like, it's going to be everything and anything, like, magic, like, animals or whatever. Like, what? There was no clear direction, you know. And I think this is kind of sliding into, like, what, you know, we were going to talk about film and stuff, but it's also like, you know, the cheerleaders, the dance crew, the dance team, you're a part of the brand. You're like, you know, literally a part of the family that you perform on the game days, you're recognized as representing the brand of the team. And so if you're going to change that up, and then you're going to be like, okay, it could be like a variety show of like anyone and anything. Like, I don't think that's going to contribute to your brand. That's going to like take away, that's going to dilute your brand, you know?
Girl, you could not have said it better. Like, I'm convinced, because that woman was so stern about her decision and kind of forceful with her vision of how this was all supposed to work. I mean, I don't know what fan she had in mind. I mean, you just saw the quote in the article where she mentions a 10-year-old kid that comes to a game shouldn't have to cover their eyes. But I think exactly. But I think, you know, to have however many games have transpired throughout the NBA season so far without any real entertainment other than the Dallas maniacs that are just big guys, chubby guys dancing or what have you, I'm sure they got some feedback, right? They had to get some fan feedback. And I heard that the World of Dance performance that they did have, I don't know, I just, maybe they realized that doing that on a regular basis for games is just not feasibly possible or practical. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But to hold, not even like hold auditions, do it all under the radar, just hella shady about it. Like,
yeah, it's very shady. In the article, it mentions something like you're not allowed to say dancers or something. Like the word dancers is not a thing. It has to be the tumbling team or something.
Yeah,
it's like so weird. It's like the elephant in the room or something. Like she's creating this taboo and making the word dancer some kind of taboo.
She irked me to no end. I am just actually getting started with commentary on that article. I think you might see a little bit more from me on Twitter about that one. It's not that I'm about trolling anybody. I just think,
Well, it's like holding her. There might be a fine line between like trolling and holding someone accountable, you know, like.
Exactly. I'm all about accountability, and you just can't. I care so much about this community of dancers, and you just can't get away with stuff. I mean, maybe before we kind of had each other as hopefully like more of a community that are more connected and are sharing information, that are trying to have each other's backs. I mean, somebody has to stand up and say, come on, man, like, come on. And I don't know what they have in store. And now they don't have any games at all. So we'll see.
Yeah.
My eyes are on their behinds, and I definitely still have some stuff to say. Very, very curious.
Yeah.
Porter ended up writing about it, because it was an article definitely dedicated to that issue. And, you know, there have been other reporters that did write about the whole situation in Dallas, Paige Skinner and a couple other people, I believe. One that was a former Dallas Mavs dancer. And so it'll be interesting. I'm here for it. Now it's going to die down a little bit, probably because of no games, but
yeah.
Nice way to try to sneak on a dance team without going through the proper channels.
Yeah, my husband is from Dallas, so that's also one reason I was like paying attention to that. But also, I feel like it could be an interesting time, just because now that there's not going to be games for the rest of the season, it could almost be the time really to jump in and, you know, have a say, like put out your voice and try to get in there in terms of making some changes. And
yeah.
I don't know what is possible or not possible, but like it could be a good time to actually speak up.
I think so too. Perfect timing. We have enough of a time over these next few weeks when everybody's like working from home and probably going stir crazy. Thanks for talking some current events really quick. It's a lot going on. So I'm ready to dig all up into your film though, girl. Let's just.
Okay.
So I'm horrible at bios and intros, but I just do want to give you your shout out. So you went to USC, right? MFA in film production. And you're an award-winning filmmaker, right? I mean, let's just pump you up real quick.
Yes. Yes, I am.
You have a long list of films, and you focus primarily on documentaries. Is that right?
Yeah, for the past 5 years or so. So I started two documentaries in 2014, A Woman's Work, this one, and another film called Who is Arthur Chu, which follows this Asian American Jeopardy champion. They're very different films on the surface, but actually there's some common themes. But anyway, for the past 5 years, I've been working on these two films primarily. And I actually started another film in 2016 in collaboration with my dad, who is a visual artist, called Interior Migrations. And it follows Jamaican migrant workers in Ontario, Canada.
Wow.
So they actually work 8 months of the year in the fruit orchards up in Ontario on the farms and orchards. And then they go home for, you know, 2 months, 3 months of the year and then come back. And some of these guys have been doing it for 30 years. It's a bit of like an experimental documentary where it looks at, you know, their memories and their dreams and thoughts as they're working, in contrast to sort of the grueling work, like over 12-hour workday that they have to do.
You know, wow. So how is it even
so, yeah,
for you to do more than one film at one time? Maybe that's just a really naive question, but that sounds super ambitious and impressive to actually manage everything that goes into film production for more than one film at a time.
It is a lot of like multitasking, balancing the different productions. But one thing is, with independent documentary filmmaking, like, I'm not working for a big corporation like whatever Vice or I don't know, whatever other network. I'm working for myself, and then I find funding for my own projects. So it's kind of like a small business / you know, freelance type of work where you're just managing your own projects, and funding comes in small chunks. So we get a chunk of money for development, and then we get some more money to shoot something, and then more money from a funder to develop it further and keep going, and then another chunk for post-production. So it's really like finding the funding like piece by piece. And so sometimes if you don't have funding, you're not shooting or you're not really doing anything because you can't afford to pay people or whatever. So, and also, you know, like for the films that I did finish, I'm not filming with people like every day, you know, or every week. Like we will schedule, like, for example, you know, for a woman's work, I had to fly to Buffalo a lot because one of the characters, one of the women, is from Buffalo. She was a Buffalo Jills dancer. So we would schedule like 2 weeks, you know, shooting in Buffalo, in this time period. And then we would come back to LA, you know, download the footage, look at the footage, try to get more funding, and then go back like a month or two later. So within those breaks, then I can hop onto, you know, some of my other films that I've been working on. And so it's just like a juggling act.
No, that's good though. It probably also keeps your brain stimulated to some extent.
Yeah.
You're completely burnt out on like one project at a time, and being able to have a diverse portfolio of things that you're looking at is probably helpful.
Exactly. It's a lot of variety. And I think for me, I feel so honored and privileged to do my job. I mean, I think I've heard so many cheerleaders say that too, that they're honored and privileged. but I truly am, because, you know, I'm allowed to like talk to people I would never ever talk to if I didn't do this work. I get to understand them. I get to ask them about their deepest fears and their passions, you know, to be a witness to all the highs and lows, the joys and sadness of their life, and really try to piece that into a story and share it with more people. So I think that's an honor, and it's real. These are real people. It's not just actors that get paid to play a role. Like, these are real people with real lives. And I think a lot of filmmakers sometimes don't treat that with as much respect as they should. You know, like, filmmakers expect a lot from the people that they're filming, like, oh, I need this for the scene or whatever. But I really try to give respect and power to the women in my film.
You can definitely tell. So everybody, I did get a chance to see the film, and I really can't wait for you all to see it. So I'm going to try not to just talk through every point, because I want there to be some, you know, reason to just hold on until you have an opportunity to see it for yourselves. But I did feel like you were very, very respectful to the women in your film, especially in those tougher moments. I just felt like there was grace, for lack of a better word, and never a time where I would have been like, oh my God, I wouldn't want the camera out of my face. You know what I mean? Like, there were some tougher moments, I think, that you captured in the film, but in a way that gave it, I think, the right space that it probably needed in that moment. So very well done. Seriously, Leah. How did you end up selecting this topic to focus on for this film?
People always ask that with a slight hint of kind of like incredulity, like when they look at me like, what made you, as you know, you want to do this film? And I always tell people the story about, you know, I, again, was born in China, raised in Canada, didn't know anything about football. We didn't have cheerleading. Vancouver does have, you know, the BC Lions,
but yep.
No one, to be honest, no one went to see their games. Everyone was going to watch the Canucks. Like, obviously, yes, hockey was the biggest thing. There were several riots surrounding hockey. But I went to USC in LA for graduate school, for film school, and as an international student, you're not allowed to work off campus. So I got a job tutoring at school, and I tutored football players and some other student athletes. So that was basically the height of the Pete Carroll era, actually, because, you know, he was walking around, like driving around his golf cart. He was so nice, by the way. He would say hi to everyone. He always had like a very positive vibe about him. So I always have a great impression of him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I first learned about football by tutoring them, and I saw, like, they didn't care at all about the assignment, the essay that they had to write about, like, whatever book. They were just concerned about the next workout, like, the game, like, preparing for the game. Everything was, their whole life revolved around the game. Yeah. And then, you know, then I realized, holy crap, like, this is so popular. It's like a religion. I mean, people say it's America's favorite pastime. And that's when I started to, you know, watch a lot of movies about football. I, you know, watch Friday Night Lights, like the TV show and the movie. You just get into it. You get into the mythology, the storylines, like the underdog storylines, you know, especially when it's like Friday Night Lights is a small town in Texas. It's like dealing with class, like race, poverty, like all these things. And you can see just how much the game of football and the world of football reflects the history and the sort of DNA of the United States. And for me, as a foreigner to this country, as an immigrant, you know, that was really fascinating. I wanted to like learn more about it and, you know, just really immerse myself. And that's when I read this article in the LA Times about Lacey's lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Said she was paid less than minimum wage when you factor in all the hours that she worked for practices, everything, and like what she was paid at the end of the season, which, by the way, is illegal because you have to get paid in California every 2 weeks, actually. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that just blew my mind. And I think for me also, this is a personal film because it's about women. It's about inequality that we all face. And for me, born in China under the one-child policy, I was not welcome when I was born. That's like this original trauma slash scar that I hold in myself. And I think, you know, a lot of women hold that scar when you realize you're a second-class citizen. You're not treated as equal to men and to no fault of your own. You didn't make that choice to not be a man. Like, you know what I mean? And that's something that is very unjust. When I read that article, that just rang true to that part of me that has always felt that way. And, you know, I felt like it would be a really interesting opportunity for me to look at sort of the power dynamics, the gender dynamics of this multi-billion dollar industry, while also getting to know this woman, Lacey, like how, you know, where did she come from? How did she get into cheerleading? What was her dream? Like what made her decide to actually go through with the lawsuit? Mm-hmm. Like everything. I want to know everything about her because for me, that's one of my passions is to find out things about people, to understand people, to gain that connection with people. I think everybody, you know, it's like a basic human instinct is to find connection. But for me, I think I'd love to do that through my work. So that's kind of how it started.
How did Lacey respond when you first approached her about, hey, I'm not just like interested in doing an article about you or, you know, kind of like I've heard about it, I think it's interesting, but this is somebody approaching you saying, I'd like to feature you in a documentary. What was her reaction like?
Yeah, because so at that time, her lawsuit had just come out. They filed it like, I think, a week before the Super Bowl of that year. So it caused a huge media reaction, like around the world. Like she had, you know, reporters from Al Jazeera. She had reporters from the UK, from Europe, come to her the lawyer's office in Oakland to interview her. It was like one after another. So she probably, you know, talked to a million people. And when I approached one of her lawyers, Leslie, to introduce myself, you know, I wanted to make a longer documentary following Lacey. I made it clear that, you know, I wanted to be about her experience growing and changing as a woman through this very sort of tumultuous time in her life. And so I went up to meet Lacey and Leslie in Oakland. And I also, you know, voiced this to Lacey and we just chatted about whatever, like childhood and things like that. And it was just like, I think she pretty much found it to be clear that I'm not interested in just being like, what's the headline? What's the, you know, cool headline I can generate from this? Like, I told her, like, I want to follow you for at least a year to see what happens. Like, what are you going to do now that you're not allowed to dance anymore in any professional teams? Like, what are you going to do? And I think we also bonded because, you know, she's from a small town in Louisiana, but we both grew up in working class families. Like, when my parents immigrated to Canada, to Vancouver, they're working like 3-4 jobs, like laundromat, you know, pizza delivery, blah, blah, blah. And I saw my mom, especially, like, she was working full time outside the home and full time inside the home, right? And we both had that kind of gratitude and, you know, respect towards our mothers. And I think we both understood the value of hard work, like, because we came from that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think there was a, you know, a good connection that was formed. And she's also just very generous and very open. It's like that Southern hospitality
thing. Oh my gosh, I mean, both of the women in the film. But yeah, Lacey absolutely had the Southern charm and very open and sincere, I think, in every way, in the way that she represented herself. I mean, you got a glimpse into her whole entire life. She had babies over the time that you guys had been filming. So much bravery with her. I mean, she was the first one. Because I think there's a perception of, like, the women that maybe have come forward and sued their teams for wages or treatment or what have you, that they are, like, attention seekers, or that they're doing it for some wrong reason, whatever that could be. But, you know, this was a woman who had cheered in the NBA or danced in the NBA.
Yeah, for the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, had a wonderful experience, you know, thinking, I'll just go and cheer for the Oakland Raiderettes, probably expecting a very similar experience to what she had at Golden State, only to find that it was drastically different. I just really appreciated just her firm, very kind of straightforward discussion of the light bulb that probably went off for everybody, right? Of, hey, this just doesn't seem right. Just curious how that sparked off, because I'm just really glad that she was open to being followed throughout that experience.
Yeah.
And especially the first one.
Yeah, for sure. It was very, I mean, at the same time, I think I want to make it clear that it was very difficult for her to make that decision. And I tried to make that clear through the film too, that it was, like, you know, a lot of back and forth, because even from listening to your podcast, it's something so special. This experience is unparalleled. It's a world that is unparalleled, like, in terms of the relationships, in terms of the job, right? Like, it's insane. You have to give that up. And I think it was so difficult for her, and it was so difficult afterwards, after she made that decision. And similarly for, you know, Maria, who is from Buffalo, and any of the other women that stood up and said something in 2014 and in 2018, like, your life is changed
forever,
you know, forever. You cannot go back. In some ways, it's like a, you know, it's like a fall from grace in many people's eyes.
Yeah, that's the part that's the most disturbing, I would say. And I've already gone on some rants. You guys will have to go back and listen if you really want to hear it again. I'll try not to get too fired up this episode. But I think that's the part that's been the most heartbreaking for me, just knowing the reason that I wanted to start the podcast was because of just wanting to have this community and sense of, like, here's a safe space where we can talk about all of these issues. And, you know, that's the first few episodes is talking about, you know, everything that popped off in 2018. And this was all happening real time, but I didn't really think about the women being ostracized with coming out in that way, especially because I was like, well, we're talking about it. You know, I thought they were, like, you said, on the media circuit. They were doing a million interviews. Mm-hmm. I was like, they're probably way too busy to talk to this brand new podcast that just formed. But it is really heartbreaking, because you're so right. They're giving up an incredible experience that was not all bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you said, it's unmeasurable, like, how unique the experience of dancing in NFL, NBA. I mean, it's kind of the same high that you just don't get from anything else. There's just nothing else like it. And you are giving that passion up the minute you speak up for yourself, which is unfortunate. It shouldn't be that way. That was one of the things, I think, too, that tugged at my heartstrings, was just knowing what it's like in after retirement, where you're trying to find your way of, like, okay, what am I going to do to kind of tap into that passion? But
yeah.
Even if I'm not doing the same exact thing. And, you know, you see Lacey going through that of getting back to teaching dance for these little kids. And, but, you know, that's a lot to try to work through, especially while you're going through a dragged out litigation process. But it's definitely a lot.
Yeah. So I don't at any time want to, you know, try to glorify, like, speaking up or blowing the whistle. It's a difficult path. But, you know, also listening to Kristen Ann Ware and stuff talking about her experience during the season. It's a difficult path either way. You know what I mean? It's like, that's whether true. You choose to say something or you choose not to say something and really deal with any issues or emotion you had during that experience. But I tried to, also in the film, I do have former Raiderettes alumni speak up in the film as well, actually. And I just have to say that I have a lot of love for them. Like, I really had so much fun hanging out with them. They what were like
event in the film that you were at.
It was a fundraiser. Because one of the members, she is married to a former Raiders player or a former football player who has ALS. So it was a fundraiser for that. And she was getting sort of recognition or award at this dinner event in Las Vegas. So they're like, oh, just come. Like, we as the former Raiders, we're all going to go and support her as she is getting this award. So it was just really fun. They're just like, come hang out with us. And, you know, I interview people from like the 1960s when it was first starting to the, you know, 1990s, 2000s and so on. And I can see in so many ways, like, why they had this extreme fierce love for, you know, their sisterhood and the Raiderettes and the family that they were able to form. And it's like decades long friendship. I think Lacey, you know, towards one of the later days where I interviewed her almost at the end of the film, she was like, well, I guess if I didn't sue the team, if I didn't bring this up, I would still have lifelong friends. You know, that's kind of the trade-off. That was the trade-off. And, you know, I think also, like, women, as you get older and you're working, you start families, you don't have, like, there's not really this kind of, like, social interaction that you used to have when you were in college or whatever before. And for women, it's like, you also are really busy, especially if you have a family, because a lot of the caretaking work is put onto women, you know? So you're, like, really busy. You don't.
Your social life is not quite the same.
Your world like shrinks in many ways, right? So anyways, I wanted to humanize and bring out the love and the passion, whatever side, you know, people were on. And that's another thing that I felt I didn't like about the media portrayal of the whole story, was that it was just pitting women against women in so many ways. Like, you know, obviously in these articles, the reporter is going out there and contacting former cheerleaders, being like, oh, I need a quote from you. And, you know, like, do you support this? Yes or no? And it's kind of like a black and white thing. But it's not a black and white thing. It's a very nuanced thing that, you know, it's not being brought out. It's just saying, like, this is one side, this is the other side, these are their opinions. And it's just rehashing that over and over again. But that doesn't advance the dialogue. That doesn't promote understanding.
And I think that's part of the reason why, even in starting the podcast, I know that I had been approached by reporters and there's a lack of control of what soundbite they're going to pick up. You could say half of the great things about your experience, half of like maybe the not so great things, and they're only going to take the soundbite that sounds good. That's probably going to be the things that you don't like. So I know that there was probably a lot of distrust in the media and the way that they were portraying those lawsuits when they were happening, especially in 2018. And I love that you've gotten to see, obviously, just the balance of why the sisterhood is so strong, why people are so dedicated to this profession, regardless of how they may have been treated or paid in the past. I just think it's great to have that portrayed in a film where, I mean, I know you don't have footage of showing exactly what they love, and I thought it was amazing that you were able to get just that alumni perspective. I mean, I know when one of the alumni mentioned, like, it was almost like she said it like, I feel so sorry for her because she, you know, she missed the boat of like what this is all about, you know, and this is about the friendships and the sisterhood. And I just remember thinking like, she shouldn't have had to miss out on that, because I think if this was really about sisterhood and everybody supporting one another, this would have been like the most opportune time to stand behind that one lone brave person who came forward to say that this isn't right. To me, that's what sisterhood is about. It's like having each other's back. And that sounds really easy to do it. You know, everybody's at different ages and points in their life, but, you know, just kind of like dug at me a little bit, because it's just like she shouldn't have had to sacrifice kind of being that lone person out there on the island and everybody just being like, well, we have our sisters and we're doing fine and we love each other and we love it, and just, you know, ostracized. I will never agree with that. I know it sounds judgy, but it's just something that's really hard because I just think that's not what community is about. That's not what sisterhood's really about. It's about standing up for other people. Maybe those who don't have a voice, you stand up for them. It's supporting those who speak up. And it's just tough because you're having to balance that with maybe not having an opportunity to dance anymore, which sucks ass. Excuse my French, but it does.
Yeah, for sure. And I think too, though, I always try to think about not necessarily judging, but putting all of the responsibility on women to change their behavior, mm-hmm. even in the context of, okay, you know, these alumni, whoever, the other teammates ostracize them, you know, friends who you thought were friends, stop talking to them. I try to have some compassion or empathy for that because it is about looking at the bigger picture as well. And the bigger picture of the power dynamics, mm-hmm. not just within the NFL, but, you know, in our society in general. So, right. and sort of the centuries of conditioning that women have gone through and the internalizing of the misogyny that is so prevalent in almost, you know, all aspects of our lives. But at the same time, I think, yes, we need to talk about it. And that's why I feel like I'm so grateful that you are here and this podcast is here. And, you know, you're creating a space, as you said, for former cheerleaders to have a voice, you know, for women to have a voice and talk about their experiences in the most nuanced, you know, ways. And it's not just about like categorizing things. It's about digging into those sensitive issues and coming together.
Yeah.
And I think if that's possible, I like really hope that is possible, you know, because without that, what do we have, right?
Yeah. And that's what's so good about art, because whether it's film, music, dance, I mean, those things that kind of force you to think and talk about those things, that's what it's really all about. And I mean, I appreciate, maybe it's the filmmaker lens, but just finding a way to put all those different perspectives on display. And that's one of the things, I know without people having the ability to see the film, but you captured so many different perspectives from the women's attorneys to team management, whether it was the director of the Jills to the Jills, the Bills president, who made a quote in that film that I just had to write down because I was so pissed about it. But, but you know, you just got various perspectives. I mean, the NFL Players Association executive director, I mean, lawmakers, like you really cover the gamut of just trying to get different perspectives on this issue. And like you said, that's really what it's about, because it forces you to think about things a little differently. And with the podcast, and thanks for the love on that, I think we're trying to, again, just create the safe space. And I know sometimes I go off on a tangent about different things because I get pretty passionate. But I think, like you said, maybe it's stepping back to understand that maybe the way that we are with one another isn't really so much of an issue of like women supporting women, but just understanding the bigger picture and why we have that dynamic in the first place, where we have to choose between right. doing something we love and standing up for our rights. That's a power dynamic that we didn't have any say so in. We're just forced to
right.
deal
with. And it's not the same, like the risk is different for everybody, right?
I think
I mean, also if you look at Lacey and Maria, like Maria is a full-time accountant. Like she has a job that she can rely on to pay the bills. You know, Lacey's husband had a really good job in San Francisco. So she was able to take this job that doesn't pay that much and their family wouldn't have to suffer. But, you know, like in the film, she was talking to her grandma, who she was a single mother and she was living in, you know, the South, and she has no other way to support her family except for that one job. So she didn't feel brave enough to report sexual harassment that was happening in her job, where a guy was, you know, groping her by the copying machine. So that's why I don't want to be like, oh, you did the right thing, but you did the wrong thing. Like, I think it's okay if you are too scared or you don't know what to do. But the best thing is if you have that voice inside of you saying, this is not right, you know, shouldn't be happening, and you see someone else who is able to speak up and they do speak up, you know, you should support that person. And maybe you can't support them publicly, but you can still support them in other ways, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in the film, like, there's a scene towards the end with Maria. She finally reaches out to a few of her former teammates because...
That was amazing that they agreed to it, that it happened. Like, yeah. I was really moved by that moment.
So that's a whole saga because that Jill's case is still ongoing. Right? Yeah. It's so complicated. It's so multi-layered. But one of the storylines of that film was that, you know, when Maria and the other women, like I think there were five total that came together to file this lawsuit against the Bills and also the contracted parties that were contracted out to manage the Jills, which includes the former director, Stephanie. Mm-hmm. Basically 2 days later after they filed the lawsuit, Stephanie, who was a director, and the Bills essentially decided to not have the Jills anymore, to cancel the whole team, even though auditions had taken place and there was a team that was selected. So all those women that tried out for the team who worked so hard, you know, were not able to actually have that experience, were not able to do the job because management decided to shut down the whole team. And in the media,
that's a lot,
right? Specifically in the media, they framed it as the team was shut down because of the lawsuit filed by five former Jills. Literally, it made that correlation, making it seem like these women were responsible for shutting down the Jills. So it created a division in that community, like right away, and a very harsh one. And so, you know, it was definitely, ostracization, and she was not able to talk to people directly. She just heard, you know, rumors that people were bad mouthing her, saying things about her, but there was no direct communication. And, you know, as the lawsuit progressed, finally the New York courts decided to certify the class of women of former Jills. I think the total was like 140 something around there, because it wasn't just her year of Jills, it was like a couple of years. The course decided to certify them as a class. So the process began of like, okay, you know, sending out notices to all the class members saying, do you want to opt in to this lawsuit or do you want to not be part of this lawsuit? And during that time, some former captains sent around a text message. It was this kind of text message campaign saying, you know, if in doubt, opt out. It was, you know, urging the former Jills to opt out of the lawsuit. And it was literally spreading false information about the lawsuit saying, oh, if you opt out, that means the women who sued won't get as much money as they were going to get, as if they were going to get that much money in the first place, right? Or if it was even about that. So that caused about 40 something percent of the class to opt out of the lawsuit, which is huge, because normally the regular rate is like 1% or 3% of the class opts out of a class action lawsuit. So this is like historic numbers. So at that time, you know, it was a very tense time for the lawsuit, for Maria, you know, what was going to happen. And it was like this renewed sense of like, people are against her, you know, it was like, she felt like she was the bad guy or the villain. And these people were saying, you know, whatever, you're a terrible person, you're trying to do this terrible thing that's wrong, even though her intention was to actually help these women and future women. So I think she just reached out to a couple of women, like via social media, like that who were on her team, like her year, her line or whatever, and, you know, wanted to ask them about it. And one of them like responded, and then she contacted this other woman who also then responded. One of them wanted to be anonymous, but there were two that, you know, agreed to show their face on camera and so on. And, you know, one of them, Maria has known since elementary school, but they hadn't talked because of litigation. Yeah. So yeah, it was like, you know, she was very nervous during that time. And I remember I really wanted to capture this moment because I knew it was really important, not just for the film, but for her as well, that it's like one of the first times that she was able to talk to these other women, you know, about what was going on. And to me, the thing that really moved me was when one of the former Jills was saying, like, when she got this text from the former captains, it made her feel like you know, really confused because she felt like, oh, well, you know, the lawsuit, they're saying like it would take away Stephanie, the former director, like her house maybe, or, you know, Stephanie has a daughter, like, and then what would happen to her daughter, her family? Like, it felt like by opting into the lawsuit that she was hurting people.
Got it. Yeah,
I think that that also is just so indicative of like how women think in general and how we, you know, think about others. And that's why so many people say like women are often the glue to a community, because, you know, we are thinking about other people, how our actions impact other people. And there's this onus on us to do the right thing, to hold, to carry like the emotional labor. I think that's another, you know, term that people talk about right now. It's a very real thing that, you know, we have to do. And you can see this woman, this former Jill, struggling with that decision, you know, but it shouldn't be about that, because it's like the lawsuit is about doing what's right for yourself and for others. It's actually, it's something that you should not feel guilt over. It's something that, you know, it's a good thing. And I think it was just clouded with all of this surrounding. Yeah, exactly.
It's not like Maria would have had the ability to, like, none of this is, I'm sure, like, planned and mapped out from a PR perspective, or at least just, you know, PR for your own team to, you know, share information and just say, this is what it's all about. This is how it works. This is how class, like, there's no probably room for any of that where you can have any opportunity to present your side of the story, the facts, you know, the information that you're getting from your lawyer to help frame up what this looks like. Because litigation's scary, and there's so many freaking steps and battles and different issues that you're fighting about at any given time. I mean, my former lawyer life, I can understand it. I stayed away from litigation on purpose, but there's a lot that is confusing about it. And just, obviously she wasn't in a position to dispel a lot of the myths about it. Like, by the time people are setting up group texts and sharing information back and forth, you're not even a part of and privy to, there's no room for you to interject, to defend yourself, to share some facts or your perspective. I think that's why I was so moved that there actually was a moment where there was a conversation, because I know that there really was just no space for that at the time that it was all going on, which is just sad. You check me, if I'm talking too judgy. But, you know, there's so many factors, right? There's age, there's just how you feel about this one opportunity to dance that you've been working your butt off. This is your rookie season, and you're just pissed because the team's taken away. And, you know, and maybe you just aren't in a space where you are able to take a step back and think for yourself, you know, like to do your own research, to... not everybody's got some personal lawyer that they can reach out to say like, hey, do you think I should join this class action? This is what I, like, there's just...
Well, the lawyer, Maria's lawyers and the other Jill Susu, their lawyer actually put out this public notice basically saying like, anyone who has questions can just call me in the office directly. And, you know, here's this, the information, like they put out a press statement or something like that. But it's like, but it's still, it's... You know, you can see how people will be hesitant to even make that call, because it then is like, oh, what if someone hears that you called their lawyer and then they spread some rumor about you, like, oh, you know, this so-and-so did this, did you know that? And then you're suddenly in a weird position.
Right. And then you probably don't know, like, I mean, I can imagine, I mean, we were just talking about teams being taken away and then sneaking them back in. You don't even know if people were trying to tread lightly just because just in case that the team comes back, that they want to stay kind of good graces so that they still have an opportunity to dance. There's so many factors that go
in. And it's like, and obviously people engage in like favoritism and rewarding the loyalty, like, oh, okay, you remain loyal, like I'm gonna reward you, you're gonna toe the line, you're gonna do exactly as I say. Like, that is the culture, right? Like, you tell me, I don't know.
No, you're so right. It's like, get on board with the program, drink the Kool-Aid, or, you know, shut up and dance. Or, you know, there's limited space to have a differing opinion, put it that way, when you are trying to balance that with an opportunity to do what you love for those, you know, however many months of the year. I mean, it's such a small, tight window, and I get that there's a lot at stake. There's a lot at stake. And I mean, who am I to judge, you know, what goes into that? But it's just amazing and fascinating to see if people don't take a step back to try to think critically about something, or or empathize to put themselves in the shoes of the woman that, I mean, this makes me think of like both Chris Dan's story and I think one of the Texans cheerleaders, but for the most part, people are witnesses to what's going on. Either they're a victim themselves, they're kind of going through it on their, you know, they're also not getting paid, or they saw somebody get duct taped, or, you know, it's not that hard to put yourself in another person's shoes because you're living it too in some way, whether it actually happens to you or not. But, and maybe it's a maturity thing, but it's like trying to think for yourself. And especially in a world of misinformation, and that applies generally speaking outside of this world, like that's today with coronavirus rumors every time you turn around, I mean, you have to kind of take a step back, process information, try to do your own research, think for yourself, what makes sense for you. Should you send you know what I mean? Like you have to kind of think through so that you come to a rational decision that's not so much driven by fear.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing. And I think that's, you know, but when you're like, you're immersed in this world or culture of fear, it's hard to extricate yourself from that, right? And Chris Dan also mentioned, like, you know, there's a point where you kind of stop listening to yourself, you shut out your own intuition about things. And, you know, I think that's the key, is to really try to touch with that. And I think, you know, Maria and Lacey, both of them, they told me over and over again, the reason why they were able to go through with everything and to keep going through the 4 years of, you know, me following them is like, they knew they were doing the right thing. That knowledge, that you know, persisted. Yeah, that knowledge of that they were doing the right thing persisted, and they tapped into that and they kept telling themselves that. And I think everybody has that voice inside them to an extent, telling you what is right for you, what is wrong for you, you know. Know what, where you should draw a line, you know, where you should be more open. And I think you just need to like listen to that voice, because more often than not, that is going to be the right thing for you.
Yeah, totally, totally agree. And I think in this space especially, you know, and there's parallels obviously with broader society, but it's just finding your way. And that touches on so many things, from how you feel about your body and your looks to how you're treated. Your voice is speaking to you in each situation that you might experience, and is trying to guide you. And I just think it's tuning into that voice, like you said, and just kind of honoring that voice. That voice for me is like, that will make me quit a job, even without a job. Yeah. I mean, I've done that in my career before, because that voice is so strong where I can't even ignore it, you know? And but that's just part of, you know, I won't say it's a woman thing, but I just think we have such a strong sense of intuition, and we're so in tune with others. And, you know, but we also have to be, what's the word I'm looking for? I think sometimes our compassion for other people can trump how we feel about ourselves, and wanting to kind of look out for ourselves in that way. And the women were just super strong in the film to have that be their guiding force through it all, to come back to kind of reinforce and like, no, you're doing the right thing. That says a lot, that they were able to have that ground them.
Yeah. And I also think I tried to, in small ways in the film, show that even though in a lot of the film, they're very alone, like Lacey and Maria never meet each other in the film. And in a way, Lacey starts off the film because she was the first woman to speak up. And then Maria's story and the Jill's lawsuit rounds out the film, because there are so many things that happened with that lawsuit. So I wanted to create the sense of, like, you know, passing on the baton. Ooh. And sort of towards the end of the film, when we finally hit 2018, you know, after the Me Too movement and like all these other women join in, like Bailey Davis, Christina Ware, like the Texans, you know, other cheerleaders speaking up and speaking out, even though they don't actually meet each other, I want to create the sense of like, you're not alone. There's other women out there that have experienced similar things and are trying to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And again, that's why I really appreciate this podcast again, because it's kind of like a continuation of that legacy, you know, the ripple effect of their actions. It was really great experience to have both Lacey and Maria come to the premiere in New York and meet each other for the first time. That's and funny. Maria was like 6 months pregnant and she was afraid of flying, so she had her mother-in-law drive her down to New York City from Buffalo.
Oh,
really scary for both of them. And they're both like, oh, we're like country girls, we don't know what to do in New York City, it's like so daunting. But it was so cool to see them meet each other and watched the film together, you know, with family and friends and all of us and the crew. And they stood up in front of people at the Q&A. It was like a sold out show. And people were asking them questions and people literally were thanking them. People were like, thank you. I mean, these were not anybody who was a cheerleader or worked in the, you know, cheerleading dance or whatever, just random audience are like, thank you for what you did. And then I feel like they just felt the sense of like, you know, coming full circle in a way of being able to have perspective on all the things that they did during these years and the path that they've walked, you know, so far. And there was a sense of pride that they took from that. And I think that was special, even though the Jill's lawsuit, you know, is still ongoing, you know, even though the reality of the, you know, world of NFL cheerleading hasn't necessarily changed that much, they can still have pride in what they did.
Yeah.
And the lives and that they did affect.
Frankly, what these women have accomplished has put a big fat spotlight on how these teams were run, how they were managed, how they were paid. And, you know, it may still not be a perfect world. No world is, but it's better, trust, from the journey that they walked. There's no more cheating the system in terms of trying to label pro cheerleaders and dancers as independent contractors, which means you don't have to pay them hourly wages. Everything that was going wrong in terms of pay and probably the scrutiny around some of these rules, that's all improved, I would say, dramatically in the last couple of years, thanks to the women that have come forward. And I love that they were able to meet and understand that there is a broader community outside of NFL cheerleaders that support them and understand what they were fighting for. You know, you've been all over the world, frankly, right? And promoting the film at different film festivals. And I think it dawned on me, I don't remember where this school was located that did a play that was kind of...
Oh, yeah, Carthage.
Yeah. But I think it just kind of hit me that like this group of women that have come forward with these lawsuits, they're finding each other, they're meeting each other for the first time, they're coming together for these panels, and it's great to see. But I was kind of struck by like, wow, does our own community, you know, maybe the Pro Cheerleading Podcast community of listeners, like, do we know who these women are? Are they really like, you know, on the outside of this circle? And I don't want to believe that that is the case. And even to the extent that it was the case during the litigation, you know, in the heat of the moment, everybody was, you know, in their feelings and afraid and scared and not knowing what to do. But now, maybe because there has been some time away from it, maybe because there is a little bit of a platform to share their stories, I just want to make sure that they are embraced. And I just think your film helps educate people about the issues, again, from so many different perspectives, and also just helps them feel like they're connected to a larger community, if that makes any sense. So, I mean, I just really want to thank you, because they probably did go through a lot of it alone. And now that the film is out and they're able to connect with others that have gone through similar battles, because I think your film has been featured with other films that are around similar issues, right? Social justice issues. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. It's been programmed a lot with like other films about women, women fighting for their rights, women dealing with sexual harassment, you know, running the gamut of the women's experience, you know, which I think is so important, because like you mentioned, like I wanted to make this film and connect these dots in a way of, you know, what is going on in our world today in terms of the women's movement, and that this battle that these women are fighting in, and in many, many ways that they felt like they were so alone in fighting, that it's connected to a larger battle, right? And yeah. I think I've heard so many women pro cheerleaders talk about the part of the reason why they love their job is because they felt like they were connected to something bigger than themselves, that they were serving something bigger than themselves, especially Maria, because what she loved about the job was doing community events and going out and doing appearances and meeting the little kids who looked up to her. And even Lacey too, she always wanted to be a role model for younger girls. And that was like one of the things that really satisfied them in their lives. And I think now, you know, with the film, like Lacey was like, you know, this is another way that I can feel like I'm a part of something bigger than myself and that I'm making a difference for young girls and women, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's another aspect of sisterhood that could be very rewarding and very meaningful is that, you know, you're coming together to make positive change, right? You're not just coming together to affirm the status quo or to, you know, affirm your loyalty to something. You're coming together to make positive change. And I think that can be very powerful.
Absolutely. And I just think that, gosh, the minute that light just like clicks in everybody where they kind of see the power that we have in numbers. I know it was something that you touched on in your film, that the Buffalo Jills were actually the only team that formed a union for a short period of time.
Yeah, right? In 1995.
Yeah. And unfortunately, just based on dissension and people who were wanting to hold out to kind of negotiate and go through these issues and deal with them on a broader level, was kind of counteracted with people who just wanted to dance and didn't want to lose out on that opportunity. So the union kind of fell apart.
But you see the efforts, right, of women trying to come together and make a difference. And I was just even thinking about, like, this is Women's History Month right now, right? And I'm just thinking, looking back on history, like, women weren't even allowed to own property till like the middle of the 1800s. You know, the 19th Amendment wasn't passed until 1919. Like, women weren't even allowed to vote. And it was only a segment. It was like just white women or something. Like, all other ethnicities were excluded. So it's like, you know, and then 1960s, that's when you had the second wave feminism and you had the Equal Pay Act. But it's like, you see these spurts of activity of women coming together, making change and achieving some things. Right. But then there would be like a gap or something of like darkness and there'd be like nothing happening. And there's no like, there's not this sense of continued movement. And I just really would love to see that, you know, that we should understand our history. We should understand how far we've come and, mm-hmm. you know, acknowledge all the work that women have done before us. And that's why I want to include that, seeing the 1995 Buffalo Joes cheerleaders that did come together to form a union. Because Buffalo also, it's a Rust Belt town. I mean, it's like a union town. It has a very strong tradition of that. But it also has a strong tradition about like work stereotypes, right? Gender stereotypes when it comes to work, like the real work of men is real work. And you know, that's women's work, you know, like, oh, I'm working in the steel factory, like whatever. And then you're just taking care of kids. Like, so it's kind of this interesting combination of all these different opposing factors. And these women stood up and said, no. And like, I read an article about that lawsuit back in 95 and it was like exactly the same language. People were like, this is not a job. You're just dancing on the sidelines, titillating men. And that's exactly, you know, the same attitude.
These articles just last year and the year before.
Yeah. And like, we interviewed fans, you know, like there's a scene in the film where we interviewed Buffalo fans and this woman was like, that's actually one of my favorite scenes where this woman was like, well, I don't agree with the image that these women are portraying in terms of being so skinny and sexy, whatever, and how, what that says to younger women. And like this male fan being like, oh, they're just, you know, dancing for drunk guys at games. Like, I don't care about them. And then his friend is like, well, you're every game, you're that drunk guy who's like enjoying it. Right. So it's this like ingrained, deeply, deeply ingrained stereotypes against women and sort of the need to categorize and put women in these categories of good and bad to judge them. And in some ways, it's kind of like you're only able to enjoy women's beauty or, you know, skills, talent, if somehow you also at the same time look down on it and devalue it. Somehow those things have to go hand in hand, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, why? Sorry, I don't even know how I got onto this tangent.
No. I'm tangent central. I mean, you're bringing up different points in the movie, but I have to mention, because I was so mad, but Russ Brandon, you know, the Bills president and CEO, said something to the effect that his given F meter was zero.
Yes.
And couldn't care less whether the Jills existed. Like, he actually, I'm sure this came out maybe in Discovery or something, and I don't know if that was an email or how
So the Jills case, it went into depositions, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the first case. It's the first case that went into depositions because
that went that far.
They didn't do that. And it was like days upon days upon days of deposition. So I read like thousands of pages of these depositions, which was kind of crazy, but again, it's so fascinating because all of this is available for the public. Like, oh, yeah. If anyone wants, they can go to the Erie County like courthouse website and download these depositions and read them. And yeah, he says like the Russ Brandon, who has now resigned, quote unquote, you know, because of possible sexual misconduct, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of Bill's organization. He says that he couldn't care less if they existed. He said they were inconsequential from a business perspective, and yet he admitted that they're a part of the game day experience, right? Which is totally contradictory. How can you say that they're part of a game day experience and say that they're inconsequential from a business standpoint? You know,
and that's why, like, and this was probably in like, you know, the Bitch Better Have My Money episode, or maybe we didn't even really like drill down on it. But I guess I just really, really want people to understand and know their worth in this arena, like in the pro cheerleading, pro dance, for professional sports teams arena, especially, right? Whether that's semi-pro, whether that's pro, like regardless, when you are a brand ambassador, that word gets thrown around so much, but you are building a $1 billion business brand by standing out there in the cold, interacting with the community, going to all these events and charity events, fundraisers. Like, you are doing work that has maybe an intangible dollar sign associated with it, but don't ever be fooled in thinking that all you're doing is dancing, that you really don't have, I guess, this monetary worth associated with it. And I don't know if maybe that's why there was such a struggle with, oh, well, I would do it for free. You know, like I really want to dance and I don't really need a dollar. I just don't want people to think that there's not a huge worth that you bring to the table for these teams. Like, don't get it twisted. Yeah. You know, there's XFL that's happening without cheerleaders. I mean, yes, a game of any professional sport can exist without dancers and cheerleaders. Duh. But there's an added value that we bring in being an extension of that brand in their communities, because that's how their trademarks, I mean, here I am on my little tangent, but when you think about a brand name like Apple, that brand is worth however much it's worth, think a kajillion, right? Because of how people feel connected to that brand and what they associate that brand to mean. And so every time that you are stepping in a uniform representing that brand, wearing that logo and creating goodwill, I mean, that's the value.
You're adding to it.
You're making that stock of that brand go up and up and up. Every single positive interaction that you have, every smile you put on somebody's face. And so I just think when I saw that particular moment in the film with this guy basically saying like he didn't give an F and that they really had no value whatsoever, it just made me want to scream at the top of my lungs. And this is where the debate, what you'll see online too, a lot of people say that there's just nobody cares, nobody needs them, what they do is not important, and they're here to watch the guys and that's it. And it's just,
all that aside, like, those are just opinions, and it just, again, it doesn't really change the fact that if a team has cheerleaders and you're creating all these rules and expectations for this role, this job, that you shouldn't,
that supposedly doesn't matter.
And you should also be thinking, like, what is fair pay, like, is it fair that you're getting the same amount as the people selling beers and hot dogs that requires no training to do those jobs, or the parking attendant? Like, yeah, like those, all those people are part of the game day too. But the moment I feel like anyone starts training as an athlete, as a dancer, as a cheerleader, you know, who invests time throughout their life from the age of 5, you know, 6, whatever age, you're beginning to accrue value for yourself. And once you get into that professional space, that is when your value as a professional needs to be recognized.
Exactly.
I think also people don't understand, for example, Mike Lombardi, who was a football exec and he's now a commentator. The main thing he was saying, you know, the NFL football is a business that almost at this point can't fail. You know, it's just growing and growing. Like, viewership went up by 5% last season. The value of this league, of the game, is entertainment. Right? He was saying, like, you shouldn't really think of athletes just as athletes and football players just as athletes. They're actually entertainers. And the value that they're paid is directly correlated to how much people want to be entertained by them. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. It's like, people often be like, oh, why are they paid $30 million or whatever? Because they have value to people, right? Like, the value that you have should be attached, should be clear, because you're part of the entertainment industry. And people always say, like, in Lacey's Raiderette handbook, it says, like, football is the name of the game. You know, you're a cheerleader. We don't need cheerleaders. But yeah, okay, football is the name of the game, but it's also about entertainment. And as a cheerleader, that's your job, is to entertain the crowd. It's to, you know, promote that brand and to interact with the fans and the community. Like, that is value, you know? And I think that even in terms of the CBA negotiations right now with the football players, like Aaron Rodgers, mm-hmm. we put out a statement saying, like, we as the players need to know our worth. We need to understand our worth. And that is how we're going to
in essence,
win against, you know, the multi-billionaire owners, right? And part of knowing your worth is seeing the bigger picture, like mm-hmm. seeing how your work is involved in this giant system, this giant industry of football, like this multi-billion dollar industry. And it's not a shame to say, like, I need to be valued more. It's not shameful. It's not hurtful to other people.
Exactly.
It's just a statement of fact.
Thank you. And to, you know, take it even that step further, we all have a job of some sort, right? And, you know, if I'm looking at my job for my company, I'm not going to say, oh, my job doesn't matter because they make so much more money and I'm just this peon that does X, Y, and Z. I'm going to hold my own about what I contribute to that bigger picture. I'm not going to blow it up out of proportion and say that I'm the reason the company exists and I should be the center of all things. But I'm definitely going to say that in my role doing X, I bring value to the table. I show up, I do my job, I do it well, and I deserve to be paid. And if I've performed well, I'm going to deserve a raise. And so that mindset also applies to our world of dance and professional cheer. And I think, yay, we got to maybe some, like, ground zero baseline of, like, hey, you actually have to pay them at least minimum wage. But there's definitely something that we can take from the football players that are going through it in their own right. You know, yes, the numbers that they're working from are a lot higher, but
they fought hard to get there.
Yes, they absolutely did. And it's a continuous struggle because their owners are continually making a crap ton off of them. And the fact that all players aren't compensated on that same level that maybe a quarterback would.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, my eyes stay on the prize of imagining a world where professional cheerleaders and dancers can have a salary that would be recognized similar to where we stand right now with the mascots, because you can't tell for 2 seconds that the freaking mascot who wears a goddamn suit the whole entire time interacting with fans and going to different events, maybe they do a little dance, but what is so different about the entertainment factor that they bring that is completely intangible because you have a bird or a duck or whatever interacting with humans.
A pirate.
You know what I mean? So you're going to attribute $60,000 of salary to this role, but you can't appreciate what a real live human can do to interact with a child and have a meaningful conversation about bullying at a school assembly, to dancing their behind off at different performances. You can't tell me that we can't move that needle, you guys, to something that's actually meaningful. Maybe it's not 60,000, but maybe we can get to, like, I don't know, 30,000. Can we get to something that really establishes that we are worth so much more than where we're currently paid? I would be a happy camper. I really would be a happy camper, because we have to know that we're worth that. We have to know that the time and energy that we're putting into it is worth it. We have to know that a squad of, like, 28 to 30 something to 40 people is still, even if you add that all up, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's earned by these teams. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, but I just feel so passionate about it.
I think one example I just want to talk about too is the Dallas Cowboys. I think when people are, you know, don't know much about football at all, when you say Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, immediately people recognize that. They're almost like a brand onto themselves, right? And the Cowboys, when's the last time that they won a Super Bowl? Like the 90s or something? When's the last time they've had, you know, a fabulous season? I'm not sure, you know? And yet they're the most valuable sports franchise in the world. Not just in the NFL.
In the world.
In the world. And so if you're saying, if you're someone to say, oh, well, you know, it's about football, it's about, you know, winning football, well, that's not, that doesn't necessarily equal value, right? The value of your franchise is about marketing. And, you know, again, the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, that's their job. And, you know, like Erica Wilkins, who sued the team, she said she was paid like $5,000 the first year that she cheered. And, you know, 16,000 in the third year that she cheered, but she wasn't paid for all the hours. And then after her lawsuit settled, they gave them a raise from $8 to $12 an hour and from $200 to $400 per game, right? So again, like that, how much money? $12 an hour for the most valuable sports franchise in the world?
And that's what
you have these iconic women that dance for you. I was watching a show about F1 on Netflix the other day, and they had the race in Austin, and they had the Cowboys cheerleaders there, and they showed them there, you know, like they were doing an appearance or something. And it's like, you know, you have the cheerleaders at this F1 event. Like, clearly they're a recognizable icon, and that has value.
Absolutely does. And then when you think of like the shifts that the teams have made in reaction to these lawsuits, where yes, we all benefit, and maybe it's from $8 to $12 an hour or, you know, a little bit more. But just imagine that that pot is a lot bigger in terms of, or that piece of the pie that they sliced off to make it a little bit better for us. It's still very, very low compared to where we really should be setting the bar of what we're worth. And that takes obviously a whole lot, right? It takes a whole lot of coordination and support for us all to unanimously say we're worth more than that, you know. We're going through auditions and everybody wants their opportunity to dance. You know, if a few people say, you know, we're not going to do it, we're going to stand up and say, we deserve more. There's 30, 40, 50 people behind you that'll be like, move out the way, girl. I'm about to go for mine. Yeah.
And exactly.
It's unfortunate, but I just think, you know, I'm just still going to keep putting it out there till I'm blue in the face. And I cannot wait to have a conversation about unionization on this podcast, just so people understand that if we actually can kind of free our minds to move in a direction of declaring our worth and holding firm to that, the sky's the limit. The sky's the limit. I feel like your film definitely opens up the broader picture. And for that, I mean, I just couldn't be more grateful, because I think, you know, with any negative news or anything that people want to associate negativity to, people tend to tune out, right? Like they don't want to listen. Probably don't want to read the articles because they know what they're going to say. But I just think for people who will get the opportunity to see your film, they're going to just have a whole different perspective on what these lawsuits have really been about, what it really took to bring them and go through the whole litigation process. There's no mystery as to why the Buffalo Bills litigation is still being dragged out. They really don't have much of a case other than to drag their behinds throughout the process, keep lowballing them with every settlement conversation that they have. Yep. Because they're in the wrong. Like, the further this goes along, I mean, they have no case to really support, to defend. I feel like the only thing that they really can do is throw money towards stalling this out to wear them down to accept whatever settlement offer that's on the table. And I just hope they stay firm. But so much goes into the fighting. And I think you displayed it in such a wonderful way. I mean, for the women that got to share their lives with someone who understood their world or willing to learn about their world, and like you said earlier, just not present it in a headline grabbing, or even, you know, sometimes people even try to make cheerleaders sound stupid or paint them in certain lights in the way that they portray them. And I just think you did everyone a wonderful, respectful, not service, but you know what I mean? You just really did a really great job in the way that you portrayed the women.
Yeah, I think for me, one thing I really like about the film is like Lacey and Maria are so different in terms of their personalities. And that in itself kind of defies a stereotype of what of cheerleaders grouped together as this one homogenous group. Right. You know, like Lacey is very outgoing, she's outspoken, but Maria is very shy and very soft-spoken, right? And it's like you have that gamut, you know, in there, and like everybody is different. So I think that in itself was something interesting. And also I think through the process of making this film, showing cuts to our funders and things like that, some of the feedback we would get would be like, oh, well, why can't this film feel more like, you know, like a story about a male football player who was really poor, and then he made it as an NFL football player, and then he, you know, did it for his family, and everybody was so happy, like, whatever, this kind of heroic glory kind of narrative. And I'm like, Because women's lives are different, you know? Like, I think people don't really understand that. Another thing is they're like, oh, why can't there be one clear antagonist in your film? You know, just make it about the lawsuit. This is a simple story. But for me and my team, like, we knew from the beginning that this is not a simple story, because women's lives is not just, you know, if we defeat this one thing, then, oh, we're going to have equality, or we're suddenly going to have all the rights and all these things. It's like a multifaceted thing that every woman is dealing with on a day-to-day basis, you know, and that's why it's important.
Ripple effects. It's super complex. So,
yeah, and that's why it's important to show Lacey, like, with her kids and trying to get her husband to watch her kids as she's trying to go and teach a dance class, like these arguments that, you know, an argument they would have, or whatever, the moments where Maria's like cleaning her house and like making dinner after she got lowballed at the mediation, or like her relationship with her mom, like all of these things, you know, it's all of the work that we do in our lives and all the different struggles that we have in many ways that go unseen, right? Okay. And I just wanted to like to show that and to, you know, bring that out, and hopefully people can understand a little bit more, you know, about like all the things that we deal with.
You know? Absolutely. No, you did a great, great job of that. And you touched on probably one of my last questions, I guess, is just in terms of responses to the film, since you've been touring all over for film festivals and having Q&A with the public after. Is there a general consensus other than they love the film? Like, are there critical questions that are asked or responses that you find surprising or frustrating or anything like that that you want to speak to?
So I've been touring with the film for, you know, almost a year now since its premiere, and we've been all over everywhere. Like, you know, we've been to over 15, 20 film festivals and connecting with audiences. And that's definitely another part of the job that I really love. Sometimes you definitely come across people who are still dismissive or skeptical of, because, you know, and that's kind of the dismissiveness and skepticism I've faced since the beginning of trying to get this film made. People will just make comments like, oh, well, it doesn't matter that they get paid or not, they can just go on and pose for Sports Illustrated or whatever, or pose for Playboy. Like, who cares? Well, I would never allow my daughter to be a cheerleader. Just all of these things that I felt like I was just affected in terms of my mental health. Like, why? Like, why? It's kind of like so unjust. Like, why is everyone piling all this judgment
on cheerleaders? Right?
Exactly. And what who are doing? They didn't choose to fucking, like, I'm sorry now, but like, they didn't choose to be revealing in their clothes. Like, the team designs their freaking uniforms.
So that's the point. We don't have a seat at the table to have a conversation about what would be fair, what would be right, what they'd be comfortable with.
But at the same time, I feel like I've been so like encouraged because of the conversations I've had as a result of some of these reactions. And like, I love it. Literally, it's something I love to hear when someone starts off being like, oh, I don't know. And then at the end of it, they're like, oh, wait, yeah. Wait, I do see that. Wait, that is, no, why? Oh, why did I think that? Like, you know, I think that has been so rewarding, you know, and, you know, I think that kind of difference is just encouraging, that people can actually have different opinions, but then through conversation, through, you know, a connection, actually understand things and have like to grow in their perception.
A well-informed perspective. You can have your opinion, but at least be open-minded enough to consider other perspectives, and maybe it shapes and helps form or fine-tune your opinion or change your opinion. That's the beauty of seeing that evolution, where somebody can start from a very fixed, closed-minded space, and then from exposure and a little bit of education and different perspectives, then they can kind of, I would thrive in those moments as well, if I were, especially in a Q&A setting where people have just watched your film. And great for the women that are able to come out and be a part of those Q&A sessions. I was really just curious, like, what the public response has been.
I think a lot of the time people are still shocked when they hear about you know, what the pay structure was, how they were treated. I think people are still shocked, even with all the press that happened after the lawsuits came out. And, you know, in 2018, like New York Times doing all of those articles, I think, yeah, it's still something that people can't believe, you know, is happening so recently. You know, some of these lawsuits are still not resolved. So I think that is also encouraging in the sense of like, you know, it's another thing that forces people to question the current state of things. You know, yeah. How is it possible that this is something that still can happen in our world, you know?
Mm-hmm. Was there anything that you felt that you learned or grew from shooting this film?
I think so much. I mean, I feel like I became an adult through making this film. Not to say that I wasn't an adult before, but I just feel like I have grown so much because, so I started this film March of 2014. And that was, you know, just the beginning. And in that year, I got married in 2014, in over the summer. Mm-hmm. Just all these changes in my life. I finished my first feature documentary in 2017 and went around with that, the one that was about Jeopardy. And then I finished this film in 2019 and worked with, you know, collaborated with all these different people and the ups and downs of like trying to get funding, speak about the film. I think just to be honest, I was a very shy child. Like I'm an only child. I'm still very introverted. As a filmmaker, like, I realize you really just need to be clear and be confident about what is the story you're trying to tell, why you want to tell it, like, why do you want to be passionate about it, you know? And I think that was just, like, tested time and time again of having to talk to people about the film, having to explain to other people what I was thinking, what I was feeling. 'Cause mm-hmm. sometimes, I mean, that's still, like, a work in progress. Like, I still need to work on that in many ways, but I think it's just like learning to trust myself to, in the face of all these questions and criticisms, you know, like, why are you the person to make this film? You're not even American. You didn't know what football was. Like, I feel like the biggest thing was like, people were like saying, who cares? You know, like,
and that's having to explain and make them understand why it's important.
And it's like they're saying, like, this story doesn't deserve to be told. Like, that's not maybe what they're saying directly, but that's what they're implying. And having to confront that, overcome that, and then just trust myself, trust my team, trust the women in the film and their power, you know, I think that was a learning process. And that took a really long time. And it was difficult, but I'm so glad that, you know, I went through all of that.
I mean, I am too. I mean, I'm, like I said, just been so excited from the minute that we kind of connected over social media, like right after we started the podcast. And I'm just super excited for you and the film's success and just the story that's out there, and can't wait till it's going to be just more widely disseminated so that everybody can get a chance to watch the film. How can people, and when can people see the film?
Yeah, so the film is a co-production with ITVS, which is this independent branch of PBS. And so the film will be on PBS toward the end of this year. We don't quite know what the air date is, but we are in the middle right now of trying to figure that out. And it's going to be on a series called Independent Lens, which is, you know, a national primetime documentary series on PBS. It's really well regarded, so I'm super happy.
Oh my gosh, congrats
on it. And you know, everybody can watch PBS. Like, maybe you don't have cable or whatever, but you don't need cable. You can just watch PBS. And it's going to be on, it's going to be streaming right after the TV broadcast for free online. So anyone can watch it. And then we're trying to also secure digital distribution in terms of, you know, getting it on streaming platforms like Amazon and things like that. So eventually it will get out there. And I'm really excited that it's going to have this broadcast in the middle of or toward the end of football season and, mm-hmm. you know, have people watch it. We're trying to also do like community screenings and screenings at schools and colleges and things like that, and get in touch with like dance programs or cheer programs in different colleges to, again, because what I really want is for dancers and cheerleaders, young women, to like watch this film, you know, and have a conversation about it and connect it to this larger conversation that is happening right now. But I think the best thing to do is to follow our social media, which is A Woman's Work Doc on all the different social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Yeah. And we have our website too, so people can like, we post all our updates and like where we're going to be screening. And it's been encouraging too, like, you know, especially through our Instagram, where we've gotten DMs from dancers or cheerleaders who are saying like, when is this going to come to my city? Like, literally someone messaged us and was like, I just joined a pro team and I'm experiencing some terrible things. Like, I heard about your film. When can I watch your film? I'm like, oh my God, it's coming. Like, it's coming out.
Amazing, because so. I think it is a story that's worth telling. A lot of people are going to experience and encounter a lot that's covered in the film in some form or fashion. And even with the podcast, they're probably going to experience some things that have been touched on in various episodes. And there is a community and resources and information and people who are rooting for you to have the best experience possible, which would be being paid, being valued, and being treated well while you're doing what you love. And I just really salute you. Seriously, this is, I will send everybody your way, obviously, with all the links to everything and sharing the updates for you of where your film will be if you're continuing to tour. I mean, I don't know if things will slow down with stupid coronavirus or what,
yeah.
But I know I was super pumped about you coming to Seattle and I can't wait for that to get rescheduled.
Exactly.
Well, you know, we end every episode with either Locker Talk, which is like a funny story about something that you've experienced. Maybe you have bloopers from your filming. I don't know. Or we can get to know you a little bit better with nice and light and fluffy, fun questions that you can answer and drop it like it's hot. So.
Oh, sure. I mean, this is, well, I don't know if this is funny because it's, I feel like every story I have that I think is funny is also sad though at the same time. So like people, you know, ask me like, oh, you know, why are you making this film? Like, were you a dancer before or whatever? And I would, you know, I recall my experience from childhood where in elementary school, you know, it was like me and like four other friends, and you know, we had like a variety show and we tried to make up a dance, or we made up a dance to perform at this variety show, whatever. But unfortunately, my group of friends, you know, they were what you would call mean girls, and they were bullying me, and they told me like, oh, you're too ugly, you can't dance very well, so we're gonna dance in a line in front of you. You have to dance behind us so no one can see you.
No.
So
okay. No.
Yeah, so that's what happened. So I was like dancing by myself, like behind these three other girls, like on stage, and it was just a very sad experience. And then, you know, my mom would also be like, throughout, you know, a child would be like, you're not very coordinated. Like, my mom used to dance. She's a multi-talented woman, whatever. But she would be like, you're not very coordinated. But, you know, then I took some dance classes. Like, I took a hip hop class. Like, I took some Zumba classes. And then I felt like I gained some confidence in myself. Like, I really like dancing, you know, even if it's just like at a club or something or anywhere. Like, I love dancing. And I feel like, also, in filming with Crystal Cruz, one of the cheerleaders that sued the New York Jets,
right?
she did a dance, graduate dance program at Hunter College in New York, and I got to go and like film some of her classes and witness it. Like, there's dancers of all shapes and sizes there, which I didn't really realize. I thought like you had to have that like athletic body, you had to be like super thin, but some of these other dancers, you know, they were so beautiful and graceful in their own right, and I'm like, oh, I just felt like so happy after knowing that, because it's something that is so enjoyable. Like, anybody and everybody would love to move their body to music. Like, that's such a basic thing.
Yeah. And it's for everybody. That's been something that I would say, especially as, you know, our industry continues to evolve, just seeing people of all different, whether it's gender, body type, whatever, just killing it and just having that joy of moving your body, like you said, to dance, and just the joy that it brings. And you literally light up watching. Yeah. And then you light up from actually doing it. Dance is for everyone.
Yeah, and like, you know, when you see Lacey, like, teaching, like, little kids, you know, she goes from, you know, we're pro cheerleaders in the NFL, you're dancing in front of 70,000 fans or whatever, and she's, like, teaching, like, four kids at the local, YMCA. But you see how much she loves it. Like, there's this joy, you know, that she has. Like you said, she lights up, you know.
Yeah, and it was great to see that in the film, because I know in watching there were points where it felt, not somber, but just... maybe me just knowing the litigation process of how draining it can be, and just kind of you're looking for some like light or some moment of like a win or whatever, but they were really just quiet moments where you got to see them having those smaller victories, and that for her it seemed like it was getting back to dance in some form, you know, just watching her balance her kids and but also choreographing in her head. I mean, those moments were really, again, you just have this eye for capturing what that journey was really about from so many different angles, and her finding a way to tap back into that passion of loving to dance is just this important part of the story. And it's something for everybody to tap into. Exactly. I'm glad you took dance classes and didn't.
And that's what I mean. I think sometimes people expect like in a narrative, like, oh, it should be this ultimate glorious win thing or something. Like she goes and like punches Roger Goodell in the face. I don't know, whatever people would expect like to happen. But it's about those small victories. And I think that's what's real life, like in our everyday life. And, you know, we should all try to appreciate those things, because sometimes they don't happen very often. But when they do, it's like, hold on to that feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you have any questions for me before we wrap up?
I wrote down one question that, because again, like as I was listening to all the episodes of your podcast and hearing different women's experiences, like especially the one that like part two to the fighter one where Chrisanne and you were talking about like the sort of the mental health aspect and like how those things were also affecting her physical body and things like that. And you didn't talk that much, but you were like agreeing with her, basically saying like, you know, you went through some similar situations as well. And like the other episodes were talking about like, you know, bullying within the team and things like that. Like, and you see like that's such a commonality. And, you know, in my experience of talking to the women too, like, do you think it's possible to have NFL pro cheerleading culture or dynamic that is free from that kind of like authoritarianism and that, you know, that kind of culture of fear? And you know what I mean? Like, is it possible to have a better vibe going on like and in that extremely competitive environment? Like, I understand how it is so competitive, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think my answer to that would be totally dependent upon who your leader and coach is. Because I think it's absolutely possible with the right leadership, because I guess what I envision for any pro dancer, knowing how competitive the process is, the auditions process and selecting who's on your team is probably so very difficult to arrive at. But once you have your squad assembled, in my mind, I would approach treating everybody who's on the team as though they are Pro Bowl cheerleaders. Like, you are the creme de la creme, and I value each and every single one of you and what you bring to the table. I've handpicked you and selected you based on what I thought you had to offer. And so the way that I think you can eliminate a lot of that mean girl activity, the competitiveness, the obsession of just nitpicking and, you know, tearing people down and apart is really just acknowledging them for the diversity that they bring to your program, being willing to promote that and uplift everyone and having them all get to know one another and understand who they have as teammates, so that you're probably more inclined to care for your teammate because you understand a little bit more about their story. Maybe you have single parents that are, I don't know, balancing Lord knows what. Maybe they're people who are really going through a lot at home or with their parents. You know, you never really know, but I just think if you're leading your team in a way where they're actually coming together as a team, and it's a job, but it's also something where you spend so much time together and you're united around, I would say, a mission that's a little bit different. You know, I don't go to work at my job today and strive for this level of connection with people. But I just think because of the role that we have is so unique as pro cheerleaders and dancers when you're on a team, I just think if the leaders actually approached it in a way where they truly celebrated the people that make up their team, where everybody shines. There's room for everybody to kind of have that spotlight. There's not one star. There aren't favorites. There are natural leaders that you recognize in each and every one of them. And then the people that you have as a squad leader are people who you know will reinforce that level of leadership and treat everybody equally on their little mini squad. And I just think that kind of mentality and that approach to leading would change the whole experience for everybody. We want, you know, if you really do want everybody to win and everybody to shine and everybody to grow, I just think you would lead from that. And I think everybody's experience is not all peaches and cream and roses, but at the same time, you can eliminate a lot. There's no need to lead with fear. If you can be clear about your expectations, you can, again, treat people with respect and command that respect in the way that they treat you. And just kind of give them a sense of a bigger picture of what they're a part of, right? I mean, this isn't really about you, individual cheerleader over there who's, you know, obsessed with yourself. And, you know, like this is a bigger picture, larger mission. And I just think if you kind of can communicate that in a way that's inspiring to everybody, where they're all proud to be associated with it, that's what it should be like. That's what I want it to be like for everybody. And I know that depending on the coach or the leader or your squad leader or whatever, it can completely change your entire perspective. And this is supposed to be the happiest experience that you'll ever have. You'll never have anything like it. So for it to be painted, because...
And it's in your prime of your life. Yeah,
your life, you know? You're looking, your body's banging, like everything's going. I mean, this is what you train for. You can eliminate a lot of that. I personally think you can have a world as an NFL cheerleader, NBA dancer, pro cheerleader to have a very, very positive experience just based on the leadership. And of course, this is the leader of your team. But I think if in the broader organization, you're also, hopefully there's a culture where they value that team and they kind of, all starts at the top. Well, I think getting this film green-lighted, getting the work done, shout out to your crew and everybody that was involved in putting this together, all the people who funded the film, just super grateful that this is out there for everybody to see soon, everyone to be able to see. But thank you so much for your time and talking to the podcast and our listeners, because I think there's been a lot of interest and this is a little snippet preview of what they can expect from the film. I cannot wait for the conversation that it generates, and we'll definitely be sharing all of your information and getting some good sound bites for people to, you know, have a little preview, just a little hint of what they have in store. Thank you so much. I feel like we've met and have known each other for so long already, just from conversations, but I cannot wait to meet you in person. And
yes,
you know, hopefully Seattle will be a safer place to be in at that time. Thank you for all your hard work and dedication and just interest in shining a light on this world. I mean, you're a part of it now, so. There's one thing that I'm going to ask you to do is take back to all of the women that you're in contact with that have gone through this process that feel like a black sheep. Can you please tell them from Makeba Pate from the Pro Cheerleading Podcast, they're not black sheep. They are a part of this world and they contributed to this world being a better place, and they are absolutely not black sheep.
Aw, wow. I'm so grateful to hear that.
They're always welcome here. We can just talk about anything other than their lawsuit if they want to. Whatever they want to share, it can be all the favorite memories that they have from their time on the team. It can be whatever they want it to be, but they have a voice. They've exercised it. I applaud them for it. And the door is wide open. So please take that.
Wow, that's awesome. I will. I will definitely let them know. Cool.
Cool. This has been amazing. I will definitely post all of your information below for everybody to find out more about you and your other films and your work, and to stay tuned to when they can watch a woman's work. Thank you so much,
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Pro Cheerleading Podcast. You can follow your favorite podcast on social media at Pro Cheerleading Podcast on Instagram, at Pro Cheer Podcast on Twitter. We're on Facebook, on YouTube, and you can support your favorite podcast on Patreon. Until next time, keep your eyes on the sidelines.